Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books and Buddhist Studies with Alex Carroll. Today I speak with Dr. Richard Solomon about his book, The Buddhist Literature of Ancient Gandhara, an introduction with selected translation, published by Wisdom Publications. The Gandharan Buddhist texts are the oldest Buddhist manuscripts ever discovered. Richard discusses his pioneering research on these fascinating texts, how the then obscure Gandhari language was deciphered, the historical context from which these texts emerged, and the Gandhari influence on other parts of the Buddhist world. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Richard, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Okay, glad to be here.
What was the inspiration behind this book? What audience was it written for?
The book was intended to what I call mainstream the project and the material that I've been working on for over 20 years, that is the Gandharan manuscripts. I and my collaborators have published a large number of books and articles, but mostly of a highly technical nature for academic specialists and philologists and so forth. And I was also interested in making this material more available, more comprehensible to a wider audience, including academics, non-academics, any what are just called the Buddhist audience, broadly speaking.
All right. And what exactly are the Gandharan Buddhist manuscripts?
This is a type of manuscript that has only been discovered within the last 20 years. They come from the region that in antiquity was called Gandhara, which corresponds approximately to northern Pakistan and eastern Afghanistan in modern geographical terms. And these manuscripts date from between approximately the 1st century BC to the 3rd century AD. And they're the literature of a major aspect of Buddhism in antiquity, that is Gandharan Buddhism. That the Gandharan Buddhism was previously known to academics and I think other people from other manifestations, mostly the famous school of Gandharan sculpture, which is seen in major museums all over the world, and also, at least among specialists, from Buddhist inscriptions, especially inscriptions on statuary and on reliquaries and other objects, stone and metal objects. But the literature of this aspect of Buddhism, this regional manifestation of Buddhism, was virtually unknown until, as I said, about 22, 23 years ago. There was one exception, which was a manuscript that was discovered in 1893, I believe, but not in Gandhara, in Khotan, which is in Central Asia, in what is now part of the Xinjiang region of China. And that was the only manuscript of this type, that is, of the Gandharan type, meaning basically that it's written in the Gandhari language, which I can talk about later. But this manuscript was totally unique and was from a rather distant region from Gandhara. So its significance was unclear for literally 100 years. And almost exactly 100 years later, was discovered the first large collection of manuscripts of the same type. This is the so-called British Library Collection, which consists of 28, I think, scrolls of a similar type. So at that point, it became clear that there was a corpus, and what now turned out to be a very large corpus, a body of textual material from Gandharan Buddhism, of which previously only this one sort of oddball text had been known, and its significance was quite unclear.
And how were these texts discovered exactly?
That, unfortunately, we don't really know. The problem, and it's a serious problem, is that virtually all of these manuscripts were found or were purchased on the antiquities market, and the actual background of them in most cases is pretty murky. We suspect that there are two main sources. One is the sort of the eastern edge of Afghanistan around what's now Jalalabad, and others from Bamiyan, which is farther to the west in Afghanistan, which is where the famous gigantic Buddha statues stood until they were destroyed by the Taliban in 1995, I believe. So unfortunately, we don't have archaeological or in most cases even geographical context for these manuscripts, which is a big loss. My dream is that someday manuscripts of this type will be found in a proper controlled archaeological context, but given the unsettled situation in that part of the world, that doesn't seem to be about to happen.
And do we have any idea why these texts were originally buried or why they were buried in the first place?
Yeah, that's an interesting question and somewhat controversial. I've written some opinions about that and some other people who've agreed or disagreed with those opinions, but I'll just say a few words about it. They were, as you say, buried. The typical situation in which they're found, again, as far as we know, is that they're found in clay pots or in one case, apparently, in a stone box. And apparently these objects, especially these clay pots, were buried in or probably on the just on the outer edge of Buddhist monasteries in ancient Gandhara. My primary theory is that these were manuscripts were buried in a ritual fashion. And in some cases, it seems that the manuscripts were buried because they were worn out, old, damaged, used up, and that they were being ritually buried in a way that's analogous to the way that the remnants of the bodies of Buddhist monks were buried as kind of sacred objects. And in a sense, a Buddhist monk and a Buddhist manuscript are both one can be called dharmadharas, that is, bearers of the dharma, and so they would be disposed of in analogous ways. On another level, this is quite parallel to cultural phenomena that are known in other parts of the world, actually in quite a few other parts of the world. The best known example of that is the Jewish tradition of the Geniza, according to which books, say, old Bibles, Torahs, and other religious texts would be ritually buried in a cemetery. And this still goes on in Jewish communities all around the world today. This theory is not beyond controversy, I have to say, and it doesn't explain the whole it doesn't explain the entire situation, because there are cases where the manuscripts are clearly not old and damaged. There's one group of manuscripts in which it's pretty clear that they were actually buried when brand new, and actually apparently even composed in order to be buried. So my interpretation of that kind of situation is that this is a kind of merit-making exercise, and possibly specifically with the intention of what I call informally dharma insurance, that these were buried in order to guarantee the survival of the dharma into the far future, because a very prominent theme in Buddhist literature is what I call dharma anxiety, the concern that the dharma will be forgotten. And in fact, the Buddha himself said, or is believed to have said, predict that in fact the dharma will actually disappear within a certain number of centuries or millennia. The number varies in different sources, but the principle is the same. So my theory, and it's really only a theory, is that these fresh buried brand new manuscripts were there to ensure that the dharma would not disappear and be completely forgotten in the far future.
And so I guess that's some of the texts that were found were in okay shape, and some of the older texts weren't put in pristine condition in the first place. So did this pose a challenge for deciphering the texts?
Oh, yes. Challenges, we have many. All of the manuscripts are, to some extent, damaged. So even the ones that I referred to a few minutes ago, the ones that were apparently brand new or went buried, they're not brand new now, and they're in varying conditions. A few of them, and this is very much the exception, we now know, I want to say, several hundred examples of these manuscripts. There are a very small number which are largely intact. There are none that are 100% intact, but there are a handful that are maybe 90% complete and legible. But that's very much the exception, and most of them are very much fragmentary. The difference seems to be, well, for example, particularly this case, in which a set of manuscripts, about I think 24 manuscripts, were buried when brand new. The ones that are best preserved, two or maybe three cases, almost completely preserved, were the ones that were on top. So in other words, these things, as I mentioned before, were placed inside clay pots and buried. Mm-hmm. So the manuscripts that are on top are usually in very good condition. The ones that are on the bottom have been compressed, and in most cases have just disintegrated. By the way, I didn't say most of the manuscripts that I'm talking about were written on birch bark. And birch bark is, when new, very flexible and tough and strong and durable. When 2,000 years old, it's extremely fragile. So even the weight of the other manuscripts, scrolls on top of the lower scrolls, brushes them. In some cases, we just have a hopeless mess of fragments.
And what script were these documents written in? What language were they written in?
Okay, script and language. I can talk about that at length. That's how I
Please feel free.
into that. Kind of my comfort zone. The script is called Kharoshthi. The language is called Gandhari. So, and there's some flexibility. Sometimes they're referred to as the Kharoshthi documents. Sometimes they're referred to as the Gandhari documents. And non-specialists get confused about this because it seems to imply that there's some difference. But in fact, those are interchangeable terms. The Gandhari language is always written in the Kharoshthi script. The Kharoshthi script is almost always used to record the Gandhari language. So almost comes to virtually the same thing. Kharoshthi script is the script that was that originated and was used in the Gandhara region and in some surrounding regions. The first example, the first specimen we have of it is from the time of Ashoka, the Ashokan Rock Edicts, which date to about the middle of the 3rd century BC. Excuse me. The Bharoshi script is very different from all of the other Indian scripts. Let me just briefly back up and explain that. In ancient India, there were two main scripts. One was Gharoshti, which was regional script of the Northwest, that is Gandhara. And the other was Brahmi, which was the script which is used everywhere else in India, and which is the parent of virtually all of the modern scripts of India. Gharoshti died out in around the 3rd or early 4th century AD and has no descendants. Another way it's different is that Brahmi is written from left to right, like all of the modern derived Indic scripts, whereas Kharoshti is written from right to left, like the Semitic scripts, like Hebrew and Aramaic and Arabic. Kharoshti script is believed by most experts to be derived from Aramaic script. And I, by the way, I agree with that, but there are some people who have some doubts about it. It's a pretty clear derivation. The Aramaic script has a long and interesting and complicated history. It originated in essentially what's now part of Syria, and through accidents of history, really, it spread out over far into many parts of the world, including into Asia, as far as the borderlands of India. So apparently what happened is that sometime before the time of Ashoka, which are the earliest specimens, we don't know how much before that, the Aramaic script was tweaked or adjusted or adapted to represent Indian languages, which involved adding a fair number of characters, since Indian languages have more consonants than Semitic languages like Aramaic. But that's all pre-documented period. But it's pretty clear that's what happened. So that became the script used to represent the local language of the northwest part of the subcontinent. And that local language was Gandhari. So let me say words about that. Gandhari is, I would say, we could call it a daughter of Sanskrit and a sister of Pali. But what that means is that it belongs to the language family called Indo-Aryan, of which the early specimens are Sanskrit and related dialects, and the derivatives are Pali, various Prakrit dialects, and the and among others, Gandhari. So Gandhari language, before the discovery of these documents, was, I would say, a partially known language. We knew it primarily from inscriptions of the type that I mentioned earlier. We have now many hundreds of Buddhist inscriptions. And those have been studied since the 19th century. The Kharoshti script, I'm just backing up for a minute, was deciphered in between about the 1830s and the 1860s on the basis of the inscriptions of Ashoka, and also on the basis of mostly from coins of the Indo-Greek kings, where their coins were bilingual, so on the front they would have the name and titles of the king in Greek, and back on the reverse, on the backside, they would have the same text in the Gandhari language and Kharoshti script. So that was our Rosetta Stones that revealed the language and the script. But what that meant is that we had, in the Gandhari language, a limited knowledge. We still have a limited knowledge, but it's much less limited now since we found the manuscript. We have these coins, which have a very limited vocabulary, name of the king, his titles, and so forth, maybe his father's name. And from the inscriptions, most of which are fairly short and kind of stereotyped, their contents. So when it came to studying these new manuscripts, we had a good basis to start with, but we had a lot of problems and questions, new vocabulary and new expressions, and many of them have been figured out. Some of them are still not understood. The Gandhari, as I said, is closely related to Sanskrit and to Pali and to other pre-modern Indian languages. And of course, that provides all kinds of clues in determining, figuring out difficult words, obscure words or difficult passages, mm-hmm. and so forth. But it doesn't solve all of the problems. And one of the real problems, but also really interesting things about the Gandhari language, is that it never underwent the kind of standardizing process that Sanskrit and Pali and languages like English and French and Latin and Greek have undergone in their histories, which is to say a process, not so much a linguistic as a historical and social process, according to which a standard form is established as the correct formal written language, English also. This was done by the dictionary makers in the previous centuries. That never happened in Gandhara. It would have happened, in my opinion, had Gandhara continued to be a great center of Buddhism as it was in antiquity. But as history would have it, Buddhism withered and gradually died out in the Northwest. So it didn't become Gandharan Buddhism and its literature didn't become canonized and standardized and formalized the way Pali and Sanskrit Buddhist literature was. So the upshot of this is Gandhari is what I call language in the rough, as opposed to the smoothed, regularized, polished languages like Sanskrit. And what that means specifically is that it's kind of like English before the standardization of modern orthography. The same word as in Old English texts, pre-modern English texts, can be spelled two or three or many different ways. And that happens all the time in Gandhari. For instance, the word for "and" has, I think, 10 or 11 recorded different spellings, a single monosyllabic word. So that's just an example of the kind of peculiarities and problems and interesting kinks and quirks of the Gandhari language.
And so when you discover these texts, you've this language Gandhari is only partially attested. We have an understanding of this language from a handful of sources. You said the language itself is highly variable because it's unstandardized, so there's many different spellings. So when you first saw these texts, did you think this was an insurmountable puzzle to figure out? And if so, how did you actually start to decipher the texts?
Okay, good question. This all started in, I believe, 1995, when the British Library purchased the first group of these manuscripts, 28 scrolls. And I was called in to examine and evaluate these manuscripts. This was mainly on the basis of the fact that I edited and published a lot of the Buddhist inscriptions previously in Buddhist inscriptions in Gandhari language. So I went over there in 1995 and had a preliminary look. First thought was that, this is going to take me a long time. Well, the whole thing grew and grew and grew. in volume and in character, and now it's turns out it's going to take a great many people a very long time to work out all of these. The starting point was, well, I focused on some of the better preserved, clearer, better preserved, more legible manuscripts. First, just looking for familiar words. And even that was not so easy at the beginning. One reason is that in this language, word divisions are not indicated. It's just everything written, continuing writing. So even picking up the words is something you have to work on first step. So I went looking for familiar words, and I looked for repeated patterns, which are often very helpful in this kind of work. And I found a couple of texts had repeated lines or repeated phrases or repeated verses. And then those things are easier to locate and look up. When I say look up, I mean looking for parallels in similar texts in Pali, Sanskrit, other languages, Chinese, occasionally Tibetan. And this is going on in the mid-90s, before we have all the search tools that we have nowadays. So I was still working from dictionaries and printed concordances and so forth. But the first breakthroughs were two texts where I found familiar wording and was able to locate parallels in one case in Pali, in the other case in Sanskrit. And then by comparing, there would be words like that were not at all obvious in their Gandhari form, but I could see where they fit in the Sanskrit or Pali. Then I could make the connection, and then that tells me something about the differences or peculiarities of the Gandhari language with regard to a particular word or a particular sound correspondence with the known languages, and then building up from those clues one by one. We're now, choosing my words carefully, have a much better knowledge of the Gandhari language than we did 20 years ago, but we do not have a complete complete knowledge. There are still questions.
And let's step back for a moment and talk about the general context of Gandhara. I think many armchair Buddhists and non-specialists might actually be surprised that at one time Buddhism flourished in Central Asia. Could you talk about how Buddhism came to ancient Gandhara in the first place?
I know what you mean when I tell people, non-specialists, that these are Buddhist manuscripts from Afghanistan. That raises eyebrows right then and there. And except for people who remember about the bombing on Buddhists in Taliban, most people find it a little surprising or weird that Afghanistan was in antiquity a Buddhist country. But it was, and in fact, it wasn't some sort of obscure outpost of Buddhism. It was one of the major centers of Buddhism. Of course, it wasn't one of the original centers of Buddhism, and I think your question implied that. Buddhism originated quite far off in the northeastern part of India, many, many hundreds of miles from the Gandhara region. But, of course, Buddhism spread in its early centuries around India and South Asia. It appears from the limited data we have from about the early period, it would seem that Buddhism spread to the Gandhara region in the time of King Ashoka. I think I mentioned before the earliest documents that we have, relevant documents, are the rock inscriptions of Ashoka in the middle of the 3rd century BC. We don't not really know if there was any prehistory to Buddhism, but we know that that was the beginning of the implantation of Buddhism in Gandhara. And we know beginning around the late 1st century BC, we start having a lot more knowledge, information about Buddhist, Gandharan Buddhism. We have inscriptions, artworks, and archaeological remains beginning in that period and becoming very abundant in, I would say, between the first and the third century AD was the golden era of Buddhism in Gandhara. And that can be explained historically on the basis of what was going on politically in that part of the world, which was at this point in history, as, by the way, at many points of Indian history, there were a series of invasions of nomads from Central Asia, generally called the Scythians and the Kushanas and other Central Asian groups, who filtered in through Khyber Pass and other passes in the area into Gandhara proper, which is now northern Pakistan, and established various kingdoms and eventually the great Kushana Empire in the first to third century AD. And these invaders typically and apparently very enthusiastically embraced Buddhism. And that can be explained on one level as a way of legitimizing and nativizing their rule over the indigenous Indian population. It can be explained on another level by the fact that Buddhism is in a universalist religion, which is happy to accept followers and converts, regardless of their nationality and so forth. So what happened, for whatever reason, these new empires in the Northwest became very generous and enthusiastic patrons of Buddhism and supported Buddhist monasteries with very generous donations. And in that period, Gandhara became one of the major centers of Buddhism throughout the Buddhist world in general. That all came to an end or began to decline after the fall of the Kushan Empire in the third century. I often try to imagine what would have happened if Buddhism had not declined in Gandhara. It would have remained one of the great centers of Buddhism. And in that case, we would have all of these texts neatly preserved and edited and standardized and formalized like the Pali Canon. And I wouldn't be tearing my hair out over these obscure words. But that's not the way it turned out.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so you talk about how Gandhara wasn't just a geographical outlier in the Buddhist world, it was actually the center of Buddhism in the ancient world. Do we see any sort of Gandhari legacy in later periods of Buddhism or in modern expression of Buddhism?
Well, yes. By the way, if I said the center, I didn't mean what I said or meant to say, that Gandhara was one of the major centers of Buddhism in the South Asian world at the time we're talking about. There is no direct legacy of Gandharan Buddhism. Texts were literally forgotten, lost and forgotten until recently rediscovered. The local culture changed entirely. It became primarily Hindu in the succeeding centuries, and then later became entirely Muslim. When I travel in that part of the world and tell people it was part of the Buddhist world, they are surprised often, to say the least. But there is another angle, which is quite important, because it's now becoming clearer. In fact, I think it's now indisputable that Gandhara was the, what I call the springboard for the spread of Buddhism to other parts of Asia. Specifically, what happened is that these nomadic empires had connections of various kinds with what is now Central Asia. And what I'm referring to mostly there is, again, the region of Xinjiang, which is the northwest edge of the modern PRC. So that area became Buddhist in the period that I'm talking about. And that in turn led to the spread of Buddhism into China and eventually into Korea and into Japan. What happened, or what we know about, is that a lot of scholars have studied the earliest Chinese Buddhist texts, that is to say, the Buddhist Sutras and other Buddhist texts that were translated into Chinese beginning in about the middle of the second century, earliest specimens that we have. Several decades ago, a few scholars noticed that the way that Indian names or Indian terms were rendered into Chinese, that is by way of transliteration, often in these early translations didn't correspond to the forms that we are familiar with from Sanskrit and Pali, but in fact corresponded more closely with the corresponding forms of the words in Gandhari, that is the Gandhari language as then known from inscriptions and so forth. So this led to something that became known as the Gandhari hypothesis, according to which the early translations, or at least some of the early translations, were not based on Sanskrit originals, which was the previous assumption, but were based on Gandharan originals. So this is something that was developed, I think, or in the 1930s and so forth. But of course, at that time, the Gandharan original texts were simply a hypothesis, something that didn't exist. When Gandharan Buddhist literature was rediscovered, beginning in the 1990s, ongoing still today, the Gandhari hypothesis became something more grounded in a reality, and the situation is still a little bit complicated, but basically we have a few cases where there are really clear and direct correspondences between Gandhara texts that we now know and early Chinese Buddhist translations. So the implications of this, I mean, I'm just talking about texts and languages and manuscripts, but the implications of this is that Chinese Buddhism, the earliest manifestations of Buddhism in China, came from, or at least were largely influenced by, missionaries, if I can use that term, who were coming from the Gandhara region and bringing manuscripts in Gandhari language, which were then translated into Chinese. You could think of, I have used the term springboard for the spread expansion of Buddhism into East Asia with regard to Gandhara.
And then let's talk about the content of the texts themselves. What texts are there within the Gandhara manuscripts, and how many individual compositions are there in general?
It's hard to give exact examples because we're dealing with fragments and complex situations. Estimates have been made. I don't remember the exact numbers, but the number of different texts is, well, in the hundreds, in the low hundreds. The number of fragments, again, depending on how you define a fragment, is in the small or large hundreds. What kind of texts? All kinds of texts. For a practical purposes, I like to divide them into two types of texts, not in terms of genre, but in terms of their status, our knowledge of them. There are paralleled texts and unparalleled texts. By paralleled, I mean texts which have direct, more or less direct parallels in Sanskrit, Pali, Chinese, etc. So, for instance, we have manuscripts of many sutras. So I don't know the number of hands, several dozens at least, sutras. For instance, one that comes to mind is the Sramanyapala Sutra, which is, I mentioned that, it's a very well-known text in Sanskrit, Pali, etc., many other versions. So we have many dozens of sutra texts. We have very little in Vinaya texts. I'm thinking in terms of the three main divisions, you know, the so-called three baskets of Buddhism. That is Sutra, Vinaya, and Abhidharma. Vinaya texts are very minimally recorded. The third category, Abhidharma, is relatively well recorded, but in a more complicated way. The Abhidharma is a more fluid category in Buddhist literature. By fluid, I mean the different schools or regions of Buddhism will have very different Abhidharma literatures. The sutra literature tends to be relatively stable. Abhidharma literature is quite different in the different schools. So most of the Abhidharma texts we have, I think all of the Abhidharma texts that we have, no, most of them are without parallel in other literatures. And then we have, so we have a great deal of literature, the Abhidharma and other genres, which have no parallel, no direct parallel elsewhere in literature. So this is elsewhere in Buddhist literatures. So this is what we would call the local literature of Gandhara. And this opens up a whole new conception of what some scholars, for instance, Peter Skilling, a famous Buddhist scholar, refers to as many Buddhisms, plural.
And of the parallel texts, sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to mention two other points while I remember. Sure. One is another very interesting new development is the discovery of Mahayana texts in among Gandhara literature. Previously, I mean, until the last few years, we were finding mostly non-Mahayana, what is mainstream Buddhist literature. Some years ago, and more recently, very recently, several more discoveries have been made of Mahayana texts, which is quite a surprising and exciting new development. Most of these haven't been published yet, but they will be published shortly. The origin of the Mahayana, both in terms of its period, its location, and its doctrines, has been a huge mystery in the history of Buddhism. So these Mahayana texts, we now know of 10 or a dozen, I think, 11 examples of Gandharan sutras of Mahayana sutras in Gandhari. So this is a exciting development.
And so you said that there are many documents that that fell within the categories that we see in the canons that still exist today, except for maybe the Vinaya, which he said was very limited. Can we speak of a Gandhari canon? Did such a thing exist, do you think?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I've pretty much committed myself to the concept, the term Gandhari canon or Gandharan canon. I think we have a sufficiently large and diverse body of manuscripts, of Buddhist manuscripts, that we can assume that it's still the tip of an iceberg. I mean, whatever we have now, and it's several hundred texts, but it's still undoubtedly only a fraction of what there actually was. And I think that can be can be pretty safely labeled a canon, with the proviso that this is what I call canon with a small c, as opposed to canon with a capital C. Canon with a capital C is a strictly defined, what's usually called a closed canon, in which some authoritative body, a council of elders, definitively and authoritatively declared these are the holy books and these other ones aren't. So that's where we get, for instance, the Bible and the New Testament. That process probably never happened in Gandhara for the same reason that all of this literature disappeared, namely that history didn't develop. History intervened and prevented that stage of development. So I think there was a canon of the small c type, meaning a body of literature that was recognized by the people who learned it, wrote it, copied it, was recognized as authoritative, true, in Buddhist terms, that it would be considered as Buddha Vachana, the words of the Buddha. But we have no evidence that it was ever strictly fixed and recorded and standardized and defined in the way that, for example, the Pali Canon is defined, a canon with a capital C, in a form, in a scope that was specifically defined at a particular historical period. I like to think of the Gandharan case as really analogous to the Dead Sea Scrolls situation. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have manuscripts of nearly all, or at least fragments of nearly all the books of the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament. But we also have many other texts which are might be called paracanonical or semi-canonical or possibly canonical, so that it's a similar situation in which the canonical material was all there, but not clearly defined and codified and delimited. I think that's very much the situation that we have in Gandhara in the period concerned.
And going off the dates that you previously mentioned, I assume that this is after the period of pre-sectarian Buddhism, especially with the Mahayana texts that you said were discovered within the documents. Can we say that they were affiliated with one school or another? Or what was the situation then?
Yeah, the sectarian affiliation is a sticky business in the history of Buddhism. The tradition tells us that there were 18 Nikayas, schools or traditions. The textual literature, such as we have, doesn't line up very clearly with those 18 schools. What we look at, I mean, historians of Buddhism look first at the inscriptions. And of those 18 schools, a minority, maybe half or less than half, are actually represented in inscriptions. When I say represented in inscriptions, what I mean is typically these inscriptions from Gandhara and other parts of the Buddhist world record donations by kings of royalty or just by ordinary followers. They often usually specify that this is a gift to the acharyas of such and such a school. For Gandhara, we have references to approximately five different schools in various inscriptions from the Gandhara region. But it's very hard to line these up with specific schools. There is one major exception, which is that we do have evidence that some of this Gandhari material was connected with the Dharmaguptaka school. That's because, mainly because the manuscripts were found inside a clay pot, as I mentioned earlier on, and the clay pot actually has one of these donative inscriptions, and it says right on the pot, this is donated to the Dharmaguptaka acharyas of the Dharmaguptaka school. So that's a pretty good clue, but it's not proof. We also have in one of the manuscripts inside that pot is a commentary on a sutra called the Sangiti Sutra, one of the very important sort of fundamental sutras, or foundational sutras, they're sometimes called. And the way that commentary is constructed is very different from the Sanskrit and the Pali versions of the Sangiti Sutra, but it's almost identical to the Chinese version of the Sangiti Sutra. And that Chinese version is known to have belonged to the Dharmaguptaka school. So that's a kind of the confirmation that this batch of manuscripts, which is not the whole corpus by any means, but that it belonged to the Dharmaguptaka school. But we have very little clarity on the many other manuscripts as far as their school affiliation is concerned. At a guess, they're likely to be connected with Sarvastivadin school because that was very prominent in Gandhara, as we know from inscriptions. But broadly speaking, the lining up the schools and the manuscripts in Gandhara is a sticky business.
And have any other Buddhist Gandhari texts been found since the initial discovery in the 90s?
Yes. Yeah. This has been ongoing. The first group, as I mentioned, was purchased by the British Library in 1994, I believe, or 1995. So that was a group of a couple of dozen plus manuscripts. Since then, there have been five comparable collections have become available, have been bought by institutions or individuals, made accessible to scholars. So four or five other collections of similar scope, and there seem to be more out there. So the total number is well up in the hundreds, as I said before.
And so I guess you think it's likely that other texts will come to light in the coming decades then, or what's your take on that?
I wouldn't be surprised. I'm somewhat hopeful that there's more where it came from.
And I want to ask you, do you have a favorite text that you personally find interesting or intriguing for whatever reason?
In a way, for some reasons, partly sentimental reasons, the first text that I actually identified and understood is the in the British Library collection is a poem, sutra in poem form, called in English the Rhinoceros Sutra, so that was the first text that I really understood, and it was the first text which I published an edition of in 2000, This is, it's also known in Pali and other versions, but it's about leading the solitary life, and uses the refrain, of every verse is wander alone like the rhinoceros, because the Indian rhinoceros is a solitary animal as opposed to herding animals. So the message of it is not to waste your time in sort of trivial chit chat and social unpredictable social engagements, but be by yourself and do pursue worthwhile things, meditation, learning, and understanding. So being a fairly severe introvert myself, I can relate to that. Skip this.
I like that. And where will your work on these manuscripts take you next? What's on your research agenda?
My agenda is long. I recently retired. I'm saying that with air quotes because my retirement has been something of a failure. I'm still working full time or more than full time, just not getting paid anymore. And so, you know, part of that, I actually set down on paper my priorities, my bucket list, as it were. And so there is something like 4 books and 15 articles on that bucket list. So wish me luck with that. But it's my work is most of it is directly on or governed by these manuscripts. There's one manuscript of this type in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., which I actually got the opportunity to visit, have a close look at a couple of months ago. So publishing that manuscript, which is called the Many Buddhas Sutras. It's about the sequence of Buddhas from Dipankara to Maitreya, the future Buddha Maitreya. So I've actually been working on and off on that for too many years. So getting that finally worked out and published is my main priority. And time, health, et cetera, permitting, I have plenty of prospects beyond that. Any other manuscripts I'd like to publish. We'll see how that works out.
Well, of course, I wish you all the best of luck with that. And I very much look forward to seeing your work on those manuscripts in the future. I just want to thank you again for coming on the podcast. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you. You've been listening to New Books in Buddhist Studies with Alex Carroll. If you're interested in learning about other new books in Buddhist Studies, head over to newbooksnetwork.com or search for New Books Network wherever you get your podcasts. Audio used with permission from Musique Délicieuse and is taken from the song Small Flower by Para Furkova.